everybody on the platform, the Deputy Minister, Deputy Minister Mwananela, the team from DIET, colleagues from NCOP, the Select Committee, and everybody on the platform, you are welcome. Can I just find out if the Chair, Honorable Chagelin, is on the platform?
Are you here? I'm on the platform indeed. Yeah.
Okay. No, thank you. Thank you, Honorable Chagelin. I will preside over the first part where we receive presentations. And I'm going to ask you to take over the second part where members will be asking questions and engaging with the presentations. If that's fine with you, Honorable Chavile.
Yeah, no, it's fine, sir.
Okay, sure. Anele, can we get apologies?
Good morning, Chairperson. Good morning to honorable members. Chairperson, from the member side, from our committee, we received an apology from Honorable Mananiso, who's currently writing exams today. And from the Select Committee side, we have an apology from Honorable Lutul, who's hospitalized. And then from the Minister's side, Chairperson, we received an apology from the Minister, who could not attend the meeting due to other commitments, and also an apology for early departure from the Deputy Minister who will be attending the Minister's strategic planning session. Thank you so much, Chairperson.
Okay. You muted me there. All right. I also received an indication from Honorable Mukacha that she's going to be joining a bit late. She was flying this morning to Cape Town. Otherwise, let's start with the meeting. We will be receiving two presentations. The one from the Department of Higher Education, what are the lessons that the introduction of the multimodal system of learning and teaching during the lockdown period, what are the experiences that we can learn, what are the lessons, what are the things that we can take forward as we continue with the 2021 academic year? I think we all know that COVID has meant that as we move forward, life is not going to be the same way as it used to be. And so I think the experiences, the lessons that we are taking away from the period of the lockdown must be able to inform us and our planning as we move ahead with the 2021 academic year, both in the universities and in the TVET colleges, and indeed in the CET. We also have requested to receive a briefing from the National Student Financial Aid Scheme on the funding decisions for this academic year, as well as the appeals that those who could not receive funding have made, and what is the progress with regard to those appeals. So basically, we are going to get the two presentations, and from there, members will have to engage. I think we'll allow that all the presentations should be made at once, after which we will then open up for question and answer session. we will then take this opportunity and then invite the Deputy Minister Manamela to make some opening remarks and direct who's going to be taking us through which presentation. Honorable Manamela.
Thank you very much, Honorable Chairperson, and also to members of the Portfolio Committee and Select Committee on Higher Education, Science and Innovation. Indicate that we really welcome the presentations and the discussion on what our lessons and experiences were from the conditions imposed by the COVID-19 pandemic. I must say that, even though we were launched, obviously, as a department and as a sector by the pandemic into readjusting the ways and means within which learning and teaching should take place in our post-school education and training institutions, we managed to, in our view, live up to the expectation of some of the objectives that we set up ourselves when the pandemic hit our country sometime last year in late February, early March. And as you would know, Chairpersons and members, that we, through the minister, appointed a ministerial task team, which I chaired, which included all the stakeholders within the post-school education and training sector, representing universities, TVET colleges, and CET colleges, to look at what our response as a sector would be. And we're guided by the objectives of saving the academic year 2021, and also of saving lives, and importantly ensuring that there is no student who's left behind by whatever interventions that we introduced. And through extensive consultations and engagements, one of the central pillars of our interventions was the introduction of multimodal learning and teaching in our institutions. And yes, many at the time when we introduced the multimodal learning and teaching intervention sought to obviously reduce it more towards online learning. And we're quite careful, Chairperson, that this is not the case, because multimodal learning and teaching involved a whole range of factors. It included, yes, getting students divided, ensuring that we send notions, printed thousands of pages of documents, textbooks, learning material to students wherever they are. Various TVET colleges were quite innovative, introducing learning through WhatsApp platforms, learning through some of the television channels where lecturers presented lectures and students benefited from that. We also sought to reduce the number of students who would be attending on a full-time basis, and that was phased in over time. And our experiences as the presentations from the officials in the departments will show was that these interventions, to a certain extent, worked. Part of the broader discussions that we hoping that, also through this joint select committee meeting, joint portfolio committee and select committee meeting, would be, to enrich our thinking as the how we can integrate some of the lessons and experiences that we've learned through COVID-19. We obviously have to deal with some of the inequalities that exist amongst institutions and also some of the inequalities that exist within students. And these are challenges that exist broadly in society. And I think they pose a different set of challenges, but also the under-resourcing of the TVET and college and community continuing education and training sector, also showed up during the introduction of multimodal learning and teaching. Yes, there's also been challenges, Chairperson, and I think we'll try through the presentation by both the departments and the MSFAS as it relates to the distribution of gadgets to empower students to be able to actively participate on this multimodal learning and teaching, those who have not been able to go back to campus. Our ideal is that, irrespective of, irregardless of the COVID-19 pandemic, some of the interventions should have been system from the work as more resources to fund our post-school education and training sector so that we are able to be at the level where in other universities, TVET colleges, and community colleges throughout the world and that we give true meaning to the objectives of not leaving any student left behind. And yes, with regards to the National Student Financial Aid Scheme, the COVID-19 pandemic itself has posed, actually deepened some of the challenges that were inherently there. And the new board is management is grappling with all of those challenges to try and restructure the National Student Financial Aid Scheme in such a way that it will become responsive, it will meet the expectations of both institutions and students, and that some of the concerns that have been raised in the past will be a thing of the past. So to get into detail, Chairpersons, on the these presentations, we have the DDGs, University Branch, TVET Branch, and also the CET Branch to lead us with the presentation. I just spoke to the DG now. He had some technical problems with the connectivity and has asked his IT to assist. But for now, I'd like to invite, in that order, the University Branch, TVET Branch, and also the CET Branch to do the presentations, and then we'll get your guidance from there, Chairperson.
Okay. Thank you, DM. Who's going to be doing it from the University Branch? Is it Tandi?
Tandi will be doing that, yes.
Okay. Tandi, you are invited to talk to us.
Thank you so much, Chairperson. Good morning to you, Honourable Chairperson, and also to the Honourable Chairperson of the Select Committee, and all the members of both committees. Thank you very much for inviting us, and good morning to the Deputy Minister and the CEO of NSFAS and all my colleagues on the platform and others who are with us today. Thank you very much. Chair, I think I should upload the presentation, and if you have it, that you could put down an integrated presentation, and we'll start with an overview of the sort of 2020 lessons learned and the multimodal teaching and learning mechanisms, and then go on to discuss briefly around the registration process for the 2021 academic year, also a brief reflection on student debt issues in universities, which, as you know, has contributed to some of those registration challenges, and and then pass on to Nisfas for the presentation. Chair, we will, my colleague, the DDG for TVET, Mr. Zungu, will come in on the TVET slides. They are integrated in some way so that we start with universities, come back onto the TVET, and then talk more in depth about the lessons learned in the university sector. That's how the presentation is designed. I'm assuming, let me just attach the presentation and put it on the right mode.
Yeah, I think perhaps it's proper if you share it with us.
Thanks very much, Chair.
Yeah.
And there we go. I hope you can see it, Honourable Members.
Yeah, we can see it.
Great. Okay, so that's the overview of the presentation. In the original presentation, we had included the information on NISFAS appeals. However, the EO of NISFAS is here and will be able to talk in more detail to that. So I will pass through that on the presentation. Just to start on the universities, and thank you very much, Deputy Minister, for the introduction and setting the context, because I think it's very important that we... It seems like it's become the new normal, but last year was an incredibly challenging year for the post-school education and training sector, and there was really a huge rallying around. I think the Portfolio Committee also spent a great deal of time reflecting on these issues and keeping us kept informed, the committee, on a lot of these issues, because so much change was necessary. But just to say that in terms of the university sector, we worked very closely with the 26 public universities initially to develop these remote multimodal teaching, learning and assessment plans for each institution, and each institution did in fact submit plans to us. And the importance of the plans was that we recognized that while a common sectoral approach to saving the academic year was necessary, we also had to save lives, and it was also necessary to ensure the Deputy Minister has focused on this in his introduction. Diversity developed different mechanisms, and this was really because every context is different, the resource contexts are different, and this was very necessary. Even within institutions, it was necessary to take different approaches. Important to note is that it was necessary to reprioritize funds to support the teaching and learning plans of institutions. And maybe just to say that's sort of common to the understanding that, if you are engaged in remote forms of learning and there are very few people on campus, that there are savings, certainly there are savings if you look at things like municipal bills and other things like that. But unfortunately, given the need to move on an emergency basis to support these teaching and learning plans, in actual fact, the cost has increased for many institutions, particularly in the area of IT support and other areas that we'll show in the presentation. So in the initial phase, certainly, the costs are quite significant in terms of this. So we supported the institution through a reprioritization exercise, and the Minister created a COVID-19 responsiveness grant, essentially through reprioritizing funds that were already available to institutions in terms of earmark grants. This was allocated to universities in partial support of the plan. It wasn't necessarily able to support all the financial needs of institutions at this time. And then the Minister supported these plans, and these grants were used to support some of the emergency work that needed to take place. Just in terms of this, we've spoken about the fact that institutional plans are significantly different. Institutions also have to take into account the different support needs of their student bodies and their staff. And it's really important to remind ourselves that this meant that and as the DM has also referred to this, that it's not only reliant on an online methodology. So there were all kinds of different methodologies employed by institutions. And so although there was a significant increase in the use of online methodologies, there were also other strategies put in place by institutions. And some of these are detailed in this slide, as well as in terms of online teaching, that both synchronous and asynchronous methods that were utilized. Obviously, not all students were able to access synchronous learning, and therefore it was necessary to bring in other forms of methodologies to ensure that all students were able to access teaching online. But many institutions also developed print-based teaching and learning materials and organized during the lockdown so that they could continue learning. Uploaded materials to USBs, and these were also delivered to students. And in some institutions, there were huge logistical exercises to do these deliveries. And we saw some really innovative approaches in the university sector during this time. Also, of course, the teaching and learning plans focused on the development and delivery of alternative assessment strategies, which were necessary to accommodate the fact that many students were not on campus for the whole academic year. But very importantly also, there were catch-up programs in many, many institutions as students returned to campus. And this is also one of the reasons why there was an extended academic year. Many institutions continued into the 2021 calendar year, and we've discussed that quite extensively in previous meetings. Also to say that the university plans addressed a number of other issues. A number of universities, and we've also talked extensively about this in previous presentations, organized acquisition of devices for both students and staff to make sure that effective operations of the institutions could continue during the lockdown period. And then these had to be distributed also to recipients. As I've indicated, some of the significant costs that universities would have incurred included upgrading of learning management systems, which needed to be geared towards a greater emphasis on online learning methodologies. Upgrades of ICT hardware, bandwidth issues, ICT security, which of course is a critical companion to upgrading of learning management systems, and also acquisition of appropriate software applications. So quite a lot of work was necessary in that area for a number of institutions. And also, you will know, honourable members, that there was quite a significant engagement with the major network operators around the distribution of data. The students and staff and many of the plans included distribution of data to students and staff to enable them to engage with online learning and to, of course, to continue with operations and teaching. And there was quite a lot of emergency training for staff and students so that those who hadn't made extensive use of alternative teaching and learning strategies were able to do so with support. And this is a big area of development that's happening in the system at the moment. So really what happened in 2020, all universities were able to complete the academic year. Yes, albeit there was a staggered approach to the completion of the academic year. A handful of universities completed by the end of 2020, but and even in institutions where the academic year had complete examinations and supplementary examinations taking place in the early part of 2021, as well as the catch-up programs that we've referred to ensure that those students who were not able to engage effectively under the lockdown period and who were able to only return to campuses quite late in the academic year, that those students were also given a fair opportunity to complete the academic year. In the majority of institutions, as you know, the academic year started in March 2021, and there's been a staggered approach to that as well, because for many of the senior students, they started earlier. And so there was an overlap between the academic year in some institutions. Just to indicate also that the department had released criteria for a phased-in and a risk-adjusted approach for return to university campuses, and this was linked to the risk levels outlined in the National Disaster Directions, but in terms of the National Disaster instructions that are released by the Minister. And in consultation, of course, with a working group with the CHE and University of South Africa and the department, we developed that approach. And that was really important for assisting universities in managing the return to campus. The criteria gazetted in June, and it was from this period that, you know, once the lockdown level reduced to level 3, that about 33% of students were able to return to campuses under level 3, and then under level 2, that figure went up to 66%, and then under level 1, of course, it was possible to return the majority of students and staff to campuses, although in many cases, it was also possible to allow for some to continue learning in distance mode where this was possible for them, and also for staff to come to campus on a staggered basis. But obviously, there were many people that were on campuses. Those who had to do work integrated learning, clinical training, as well as people who had to do research in laboratories. That was very carefully managed by universities. And also important to note, and these are still in place, that all universities had established a COVID-19 task team. Those are task teams that were in place to largely manage the health and safety aspects of the return process, but also to engage with the academic decision-making that needed to take place. And of course, there was the considerable support that needed to be put in place to ensure the kind of ongoing health and safety initiatives. Higher Health had supported us in preparing and all kinds of areas, conduct of examinations, around staff screening of staff and students coming onto campus, around the managing of outbreaks and such things, and also around classes and how to manage teaching and learning under the pandemic and under the different phases. So that information was regularly communicated with institutions supported by Higher Health. I've indicated that we worked with the major network operators. This was to provide data bundles for students and a reduction in the costs of these. Universities, during the lockdown, made data bundles available to their students and staff. However, of course, once students were able to return to campus, by and large, they were able to access university and on-campus Wi-Fi, and the need for data perhaps reduced at that point. Also very important to note that university websites and learning management systems, as well as across the school education system, were zero rated to allow for access by students. This is a very important initiative that was engaged with by the department. And special rates were negotiated also for NIFAS and for the Lushaka funded students. Data provision, according to our own reflections on this, required for online teaching, remained quite high across the system. This is the data that was reported to us on a bi-monthly basis by universities. It was approximately 88% for undergraduate students and 87% for NIFAS students, and this was as reported. But an important point, of course, that, you know, those 12 and 13% of students had struggled, and so it was therefore very important that the teaching and learning plans and assessment plans of institutions were able to take into account the needs of all their students, including those who might have had difficulty engaging during this period. And a variety of methodologies were employed, as we have discussed, but I will also discuss a little bit later about the work that we feel that we need to do to just engage a little bit more in depth about some of these matters. A number of institutions also did put in place mechanisms to provide electronic devices, predominantly laptops, although of course there were delays in international supply given that the pandemic was affecting the whole world. Some institutions were able to make devices available early in the year, and others were more delayed in that given the delays in supply. But of course, others did not have the funding available to do that, and had indicated that they would utilize the NIFAS process on this. And I think that we've reported quite extensively on this and to delays. According to the report that we, the extent to which students who needed laptops therefore varied quite considerably. So in some universities where universities were reliant on the NIFAS process, very few students had access to devices. Certainly they had access to smartphone devices, but not necessarily to laptops or tablets. And then in over 18 institutions, there were over 70% of students had access to devices. So as much as there were challenges for a number of students and institutions, quite a significant number of students were able to access devices for support. An average across the system in February 2021, which was the last monitoring report that we had done on the 2020 academic year, showed that 74% of students who required laptops had been supported to obtain one. That was across the sector, and 66% of NIFAS students. And obviously, obviously a reduction in that was to a certain extent informed by the delays with that process. The department also worked very closely with the universities on their return plans, particularly on issues of campus readiness. And I have already spoken on this monitoring tool, but we were monitoring on a bi-monthly basis. And I've also spoken already about the protocols and guidelines developed by Higher Health. We did monitor very regularly the implementation of multimodal teaching and learning and assessment. And we are looking at doing much more in-depth analysis of those reports in collaboration with the CHE. And I will talk to that shortly. I think that the next slide is on TVET. So if it's okay with you, I'll hand over to my colleague who will talk a little bit about the 2020 year in TVET. And then I will come back to just do some brief reflections on some of the lessons that we've learned following the 2020 academic year. Mr. Zungu, I'll continue to do the slides if you're okay with that.
It's fine, and greetings to the Honourable Chairperson Mapulane and the Honourable Chabale. But it's fine, and also let me greet the Honourable Deputy Minister and other Honourable Members, as well as my colleagues from the department. And
I'm not sure whether it's my gadget, but there seems to be an echo from your side. I don't know whether you are... I don't know what could be the reason, but there is definitely an echo coming from my side. I don't know. Try again. Maybe let's see if...
Okay. No, I think there is a... Because it's just a table.
Continue.
Yeah, okay. No, thanks, Honourable Chair. Let me thank my colleague, Dr. Louis. Perhaps just before I proceed with slide number 9, just to give a bit of background and sketching of the design of the academic programs for the TVET, in particular the NCV as well as the report 191, which is popularly known as the NATED programs. That for NCV, I think it became a little bit difficult to implement the multimodal teaching and learning platforms because of its nature, how they are designed. NCV, they consist of 30%, which is theory, that can be easily integrated on these platforms. But if you look at the fact that 70% has to be the practicals, now the practical component becomes very, very difficult to do it online unless if we have advanced to a situation where we have what we call simulated environment on an online platform. And we are not there yet. And I think that was one of the major difficulties for the NCV. But when it comes to NATED, Honorable Chairperson and members, NATED programs, they were designed for people who were already employed. They would have come to the institutions to do theory only, which makes it easier to put it on an online platform. So the NATED programs can easily be integrated on the online platform because students in the main, be it engineering, be it business studies, they will come for theory because the practical component has to be done in their workplaces. For engineering, it's 3 months at the college. For business studies, it's 6 months, and then they go back to workplaces where they will then gain their practical component. But let me go straight now on the presentation. The multimodal learning in TVET colleges, it was an urgent response, as the Honorable Minister and Dr. Louis has already said, due to the COVID-19 pandemic. And as such, we required a realistic consideration of what was possible for implementation across the 50 colleges and more than 270 sites of learning. So our sites are even more than what the university will probably have. The learning remains in place primarily to accommodate the physical distancing. Two key conditions have underpinned the delivery of the multimodal learning for TVET students. One was the absence in the main of devices and internet connectivity for lecturers and students, with minuscule exceptions across the TVET subsystem. Dr. Lewin, I think, was already elaborated on this challenge that we had. This means that multimodal learning, in essence, could not be premised on the use of devices and ready access to the internet. The protracted period to implement physical distancing, which impacted regular timetabling to meet the curriculum requirements. Next slide. Initiatives in support of multimodal learning included the DSTV broadcast, very first initiative under lockdown level 5, which included Southern TV channel 265. There was also radio broadcast, e.g. Lekwalakwala in Mpumalanga and other provinces, Kopanom FM, Lichval Zero and Mabato FM in Northern West. There were other local radio stations that were used throughout the country by various institutions, depending on where they were located. We also utilized the social media platforms such as Facebook pages, WhatsApp groups. Other institutions went for proper learner management systems using Moodle, Blackboard and other platforms. At the beginning of the pandemic, about 20% of public colleges engaged on a multimodal learning. To date, there are more than 80% of colleges that have integrated multimodal learning in their teaching and learning strategies. Although I must say there has been less in terms of having proper management system that can integrate both lecturers and students, where they can be monitor the progress of each student at all times. Few of the colleges have moved to that level, but gradually some of them are getting there. The next slide. The enablers for effective use of multimodal learning, the investment in technological resources that support learning, such as LMS, Wi-Fi connectivity and laptops for students and lecturers, is one of the requirements that we will need, and still a big challenge in terms of all of them getting the development, the use of remote learning platforms, especially with regard to facilitation skills in using remote learning platforms. A number of initiatives in this regard have taken place. We have, for instance, the partnership with the Germans, where they've already assisted us in terms of ensuring that this program is indeed assisting us in getting and developing our lecturers to be able to make use of these platforms. There is also other partnerships on stakeholders that are assisting us in reducing the cost. I've already mentioned the GIZ, the ICT expertise that we have acquired, for example, through Cisco, which are also helping us. The engagements with the different mobile network operators for zero rating of college websites, and I think this has also assisted us. Effective regional support structures for coordination and consolidation of initiatives, examples in the Northern and Western Cape, where we have a centralized capacity building program that have been rolled out. The next slide. In terms of the lessons learned, I think this will be Dr. Lewin, as it will be talking to the universities, and soon after that, it will be the lessons learned for TVET colleges. Thank you, Honorable Chair.
Thanks very much, Mr. Zungu. So just to talk about the lessons learned in terms of student engagement, again, we have quite high levels of student participation reported. No universities reported percentages higher than 10% for students who were not engaged, and only four reported higher than 5%. However, I mean, these are the kinds of things that we feel do need deeper analysis. It's still a fairly large group of students, and of course, very important important that those students were given other opportunities. And most of the ways in which this was measured was, you know, looking at learning management systems and how students were accessing those and how frequently. But universities also did use other points of analysis that we will engage a little bit with. The average percentage across the system for students not engaged was 2% in January 2021, and then again decreased in February 2021. But of course, by this time, a number of universities had completed the academic year, and in some cases, students were involved in catch-up programs and quite a number of concluded assessments. And it also decreased in the number of students who were not engaged, because also universities had prioritized the return to campus for these students. And many of those students were engaged on campus, even if they hadn't been beforehand. Just also wanted to inform honorable members that we had also, in some ways quite luckily, coincided with work that we were planning to do to look at how students were accessing learning materials, particularly given the change in the NIFSAS learning material allowance delivery, so that students were getting, from 2019, were getting the allowance in cash. And, of course, we're able to use that to buy learning materials and also to buy electronic devices. And the survey report was really intended to try and give us information about how students were actually learning and whether or not they were accessing the appropriate learning materials in the way that we hoped they were. And the survey report was produced in December 2020. It is publicly available and can be shared more widely. And just thought it would be useful to share some of the lessons from this survey. Obviously, it does show that, because initially we had intended to conduct the survey early in the academic year, but immediately following the lockdown and in that period of moving to remote teaching, of course, institutions were doing a lot of surveying of their students and staff themselves. So we didn't want to overwhelm the system with too much surveying. We moved it into later in the year, and it started in August, and then by October we had a report. But really showed that the pandemic pushed the sector to rapidly adapt to the circumstances. And of course, some very new experiences. And students' responses were able to give us a sense of what things had been like before and after, and a sense of how easy and in some cases how difficult it was for students and staff to adapt to new technologies and new ways of offering and teaching and learning. But of course, also some very interesting findings that in some ways there are positives about technology in the teaching and learning space. And although there's a very strong view that technology should not replace teaching and learning in face-to-face and contact learning, it is possible to utilize technology more effectively to support teaching and learning. And so this is really a shift that we need to do more work on. But in order for that to happen, the survey made a number of recommendations. And of course, you know, at the basic level, really ensuring that all staff and students have access to basic learning is a fundamental issue. And that includes having appropriate device connectivity, data, obviously, if you're off campus, and connectivity on campus is very, very important. And of course, we have to address some of the digital divide issues and inequalities that exist in the system there. Some of that came out quite strongly from the survey. And of course, the survey would also have been limited in terms of the students that would have participated, although the participation was very strong, and there were students from 24 institutions that responded. But of course, there may have been students who had difficulty engaging with the survey. Prioritizing digital skills development has come through as a very strong issue, both on a national and an institutional level, and really important that there's support to empower staff and students to succeed. And obviously, a very strong message around the need to develop more flexible content delivery platforms. A lot of this work is taking place at individual institutions, also taking place at a system level, and also taking place in the TVET sector quite strongly as well. But how can we provide more affordable use of textbooks and developing materials that are institutionally based, but how can these be made available as open educational resources? So a really big area of work that is already underway to a certain extent, but something that needs to be scaled up quite considerably in the system. Obviously, an important discussion around how financial aid supports students to access the necessary support, and just in terms of how we can develop a comprehensive student funding model that is also able to support students who are not only NISFA funded, and who also struggle to afford what is necessary in order to support their study. And a very clear message around investing in technological capacity, and also in enhanced pedagogical practices that are flexible and adaptable to some of the disruptions that we are experiencing now, that we experienced last year, and we are really likely to experience going forward. So just that important need for institutions to adapt to technological change and the importance of technology in using technology to support teaching and learning. And we're also looking at embarking on collaborative initiatives. I'll just talk a little bit about that in the next slide. We're particularly concerned about issues of quality assurance and quality enhancement and how this work can be done, under the new normal. This is something that came through from the survey, but it's something that we've been discussing in some depth with the Council on Higher Education. I think it would be better disruptive if I can just carry on with the reflections on the university and then take you back to TVET, because I see the slides jump around a bit. In terms of student success, across the first semesters in 2019 and 2020, we've seen a lot of really big differences here. And the universities reported the same or higher first semester success rates in many institutions, 16 institutions in fact, whereas only 8 universities reported possibly a lower success rate for 2020. And of course, what's important is that once we get the HEMIS data for 2020, the audited data, we're able to look at this in more depth and try and understand what was happening across the system. But essentially, the average success rates across the system did not change all of that much. And of course, these are things that we really do need to do more deeper analysis on, the student performance and the challenges that many students face in engaging with multimodal forms of learning. So while for many it may have worked, we're also aware that it hasn't worked for everyone, and I think we do need to look at that in more depth. We know about the challenges of data access when students are off campus, and we know that there's a need for electronic devices. And we'll talk more about this, but institutions have worked extensively towards supporting access to devices through their own schemes. And then just to quickly reflect on this, and then I'll take you back to the TVET slides. We just didn't want to break the flow on this matter. In terms of what we're doing now, we acknowledge that there's a need to do quite considerably more work to understand really what's happening in the system and what happened in 2020. And particularly, we've had a number of discussions in the sector and with the CHE, and I know that the portfolio committee members would also be concerned with some of these issues. What did the lockdown and the emergency responses mean for assessment in universities? What did it mean for the issues of academic integrity? And what are some of the changes that have happened there? Have they affected issues around academic integrity, and have they affected the quality of assessment practices? So just to indicate, those are some of the questions that we're asking. But we have administered a monitoring tool for this year, which has just received the first reports back. So we are looking at some of these issues, and also to note that we have asked all the universities to submit teaching and learning and assessment plans for 2021, and in those plans, we have asked them to specifically address some of these issues, to ask on their observations on some of these matters, and having assessment, academic integrity, and other issues during the year. So we are in the process of starting to analyze those teaching and learning plans. We are working very closely with the Council on Higher Education because of its responsibility for quality assurance. And we are also keen, while the CHE is very keen that there should be some kind of mature evaluation of teaching and learning happening, we're working on developing the parameters of that work, as well as looking at what the reconceptualization of teaching and learning might be for the higher education sector. So quite a lot of work needs to be done and a number of discussions ongoing about how on the one hand we can understand better what happened in 2020, continue to monitor what's happening in 2021, and also really think within the sector and develop mechanisms of trying to gear the system towards some of the changes that are both positive and challenging for institutions. So the USAF and CHC are also working closely on analysing the challenges that are faced by academic staff. And this is also going to be a very, very important piece of work in understanding and complementing the work that was done in relation to students' access to learning materials, but also understanding what effects have been on staff and what kind of support that staff, particularly academic staff, need in this context. In terms of the teaching and learning plans, also to indicate that the CHC has also asked for that information from private institutions. And obviously there's a responsibility to also engage with private institutions, and hopefully that analysis will also be done at the system level, both for public and private. So important to just note that. And obviously the measure evaluation issues will be looking at student success matters as well. Also to indicate that the CHE is engaged in a new round of institutional audits, which are commencing this year. And so these COVID-19 related issues of how teaching and learning is changing in institutions, issues of how universities can use more blended learning methodologies in their ongoing day-to-day work in teaching, learning, and research support. And all of this will form part of the work that we need to do more analysis on. And the CHE has also indicated to us that they are looking at also wanting to develop guidelines in this area to support institutions that are moving more onto utilizing learning. So that's some of the work we are at the moment. It's really very, very important for our system. And I will take you back now to, I'm sure we can, in discussion, we'll be able to answer some of those questions more in depth, but I'm going to just take you back to the TVET lessons learned section so that Mr. Zungu can pick up on those.
Thanks, Dr. Lowy. Well, I think from the TVET side, in terms of the lessons learned, firstly, I think for TVET, the better option was having the blended learning, because the issue of the lack of devices and the connectivity, looking for data, became a challenge. So it then required a mixture of having face-to-face tuition, at some point guided by self-studies, where students will use notes and maybe come on campus to download the content and then go back home so that they can be able to continue with their studies. So I think it was a bit of a challenge, but the students made use of your WhatsApp groups, and they were able to share the content as well as the lecturers. As I've highlighted, the issue of connectivity remains a challenge for the students to access internet, especially when they are at home, but some will move to what we call the Wi-Fi hotspots, internet cafes and so forth, where they can be able to download the material offsite. Ideally, you would have wanted platforms where there's less utilization or need for data per se, but at this point in time, those are very limited to particular areas, and it becomes a challenge particularly for the remote colleges, which are very far from the areas where you can access data. The provision of devices as well, it became a bigger lesson for us because I think the students were prioritized, yet the lecturers were not prioritized. And I think this is one provision that has to be made so that they could could be continuous interaction between the students and the lecturers for them to be able to assist them, provide guidance even when they are not on campus. But without lecturers having next slide. The other issue that we just spoke about was without the requisite competencies to deliver remote learning, because lecturers were not really geared for this particular situation, and it's one of the lessons that we've learned, that we need to develop not just students but also our lecturers in terms of the digital skills, how to prepare lessons, how to make sure that we are able to do assessments online, and how do we make sure that there is proper quality control of those assessments that you do online. The development of digital curriculum content to support online and remote learning is vital in the current delivery that is useful and to ensure the success of students. Well, at this point in time, we are incurring huge costs as colleges are trying to make sure that they implement this, but to set up is quite expensive, because some of them are still even not yet connected, where you would have ordinarily having lecturers coming to the college, recording their lessons and then flighting them or sending them to the students. At this point in time, some of the teaching and learning space is not even geared to do that. The other area is this issue of conducting student assessments. It is a challenge if it is done online, but I'm sure if we look at some of the best practices, in particular the universities who have been advanced in doing this, those universities that would have business schools, for instance, they've been doing these kind of things where students can write and do assessments online. But in our case, our exams are regulated nationally, and they have to be conducted in a physical space, and with the limitations of COVID, that also becomes a challenge for us to do. The practical learning, as I've already in my opening remarks, is compromised unless students receive hands-on exposure to workshops, laboratories, simulators, etc. Videos, YouTube cannot serve as a proxy for this purpose, but in combination can be purposeful and effective. So which means even our National Examination and Assessment Unit needs to adapt to these kind of conditions and regulations so that these can be also accommodated. I know that the result that just came out of UMALU's that in terms of the conduct of examinations for public private colleges has been good, and that there were less irregularities as compared to the private private colleges. But I think we just need to make sure that we strengthen that unit as well and make sure that it also adapts to this new normal. Next slide. Was the limited technology infrastructure. and challenges with connectivity to support the online applications and registrations. As you know, Honorable Chair and members, that with the COVID, there were limitations in terms of students coming in numbers to do enrollment. So as a result, colleges tried to introduce the online applications, which also posed a challenge where there was no connectivity. Next slide. The next province or next region is Free State and Gauteng, with Ebonyland West always leading the pack. But obviously there was a challenge at Southwest Gauteng Tivat College that has not submitted their data as yet due to systemic issues. But also the late release of results was reported as a challenge for them not reporting on their latest enrollment numbers. The next slide. KZN, the next pack at 13,500 students, there was the registration at some colleges was very slow because of internet connectivity, as I've already alluded to the fact that some colleges tried to introduce the online registration, but the connectivity is still a major challenge. Again, as I've said, the late release of results impacted negatively on the timely registration of returning students because they didn't know whether they progressed to the next level or not. But this also, Honorable Chair, also had a ripple effect because if these are not finalized, it also delays on the NSFAS side to make the funding decisions because the results have not been released as yet. The next slide. The next province is Limpopo, with Capricorn and Lembe leading the pack, as always. But the major challenge is there that most students still rely on campus facilities for online registration due to the lack of data and gadgets wherever they are. So they will then try to come to campus. But coming to campus, we have to comply with the COVID-19 regulations and protocols. Next slide. The next one is Mpumalanga and the Northwest region. We have two colleges that have experienced challenges in terms of submission of data, that is Taleto and Vuselela, but they have promised that they will be submitting their data soon. Part of the challenges is that the paper-based application system is still used in the main Mpumalanga TVET colleges, but the connectivity is also posing a major challenge in both Vuselela and Taleto College. Next one. The next one is Northern Cape and Western Cape region. Only one college there that has not submitted is False Bay, that has not submitted. But we also have North Link that only reported 93 students in their first submission. But they have submitted data. I think it was on the week of the 13th of May, which must still be processed for it to reflect. So at the moment, they reflect only 93 students, which is not a true reflection of their student population. Challenges in the Northern Cape TVET colleges experience challenges with online systems and connectivity during enrollments. It's a similar challenge that has been faced by the other colleges in the other provinces as well. The next slide. I think that will be the end of the Honorable Chair. Thank you very much.
Let me just apologize for the jumping around in the presentation. But we were also asked to reflect on the registration, and as has been done for TVET colleges, just very briefly to reflect on the 2020 run registration period and the universities. And we have presented previously on the university's plans to commence the 2021 academic year in a staggered way, with registration taking place at different times for returning students and for first-time entering students. And regrettably, as we all know, in some universities, the registration for the F10 students was impacted by the delay in confirming funding for NSFAS qualifying F10 students. There was quite some concern about this. However, with engagement with the universities, we were able to agree that the deadline for registration needed to be extended, at those institutions where students have not yet been able to register because they did not know their financial status and couldn't be cleared for registration, that did happen. There were a number of engagements taking place at the time, this is predominantly in March this year, with various engagements addressing matters relating to the NISPA shortfall, which we have addressed in other presentations as well, and several meetings were held with relevant stakeholders, and following the engagements and, of course, following the Cabinet decision that we would reprioritize funding to address the NISPA shortfall, first-time entering NISPA qualifying students were able to be cleared for registration. And universities also agreed to assist students through their processes, particularly for those who are non-NISPA qualifying, and there are a number of mechanisms in place to assist students who have debt to register, where possible, giving priority to those in good academic standing, those who are due to complete their degrees. What happens if students have to sign acknowledgement of debt forms and they commit to a plan to pay the outstanding fees based on terms that are agreed to by the university? And these cases have to be dealt with on a case-by-case basis because they are dependent on the university and student circumstances. Just to indicate that, well, we've provided the list of institutions there, but first-year registration started in March in the predominant number of universities, and a lot of universities had online, a combination of online registration as well as face-to-face, but a great deal of universities moving more and more towards online registration at the time, and the admission process at MET was delayed, there were some disruptions at some institutions, but by and large, most of the institutions were able to register students, of course, albeit with the delays that resulted from some of the funding issues that came up. Just to reflect a little bit on the student protests at the start of the 2021 academic year, just to indicate that they were primarily driven by registration challenges that I've indicated that were faced by students when NISPA funding had not yet been confirmed, but also, of course, driven significantly by students who are struggling with debt and who, as a result, were facing challenges registering at different institutions. And this, of course, is a systemic issue that needs to be addressed systemically, but also needs to be considered as part of the discussions that we are looking at in terms of the review of student funding. We did very tragically have a protest that took place at University of at Vist University, but of course took place in the Braamfontein area and resulted from police action in a tragic death of Mr. Ntokozisi Tumba, who was not a student. Of course, in the following week, there was some disruption across the system, particularly following a call from SAWS, the South African Union of Students, to implement a national shutdown so that we could deal with all of these demands, which were primarily around the issues of funding and student debt and matters relating to financial aid, matters that students have consistently raised with the department and at the portfolio committee as well. And of course, a number of institutions did experience some disruption. Also, a number of institutions didn't join the process, and this was because many institutions were actually still engaged with assessments at this time. And because registration activity was happening online, many students were not yet on campus. And so a lot of the process that did take place took place off campus, and as a result, there was very minimal damage or disruption on campuses. Maybe also just to acknowledge that there were some challenges with online registration, and where that happened, institutions were able to implement other strategies to ensure registration, and including extending the registration period for students. And from what we have seen in the last month or so, mostly the registration period has come to an end, and the academic year has been well underway in the majority of the demands that students had raised were engaged with SAWS and SRCs and respond to those systemic challenges. Of course, there are many issues that require longer-term work, and those are matters that we are working on in other areas, in particular dealing with the issues of student debt. And of course, many institutions were also able to make concessions to students, and it was done on a case-to-case basis. But at a systemic level, we acknowledge that these are still areas where we need to do more work. And just in conclusion, Chair, if I could just go to the slides that do look at, I'm going to skip the NSFAS ones because I know that they will be dealt with by Andile. But in terms of the historic debt, just to remind that in 2018, government contributed, well, 2019 actually, the money was transferred to NSFAS, contributed the 1.7 billion amount. This followed a due diligence exercise that was undertaken in 2018 to identify the historic debt of NSFAS qualifying students who were registered in 2018. This significant amount was faced by students who were subject to the original family income threshold of 122,000 and then also subject to the NSFAS funding cap. And just to indicate that those students, the debt of those students subject to funding available, of course, is being also addressed for those who were registered subsequently in later years as returning students. But at the end of the day, the students do have to meet the academic progression criteria, and for the amounts being claimed for, they also had to sign an acknowledgement of debt with the institutions. And, of course, this project is still a work in progress. It's subject to significant audit processes required by NSFAS, and it has not yet been finalized. Engagement between institutions and NSFAS is in place. So while the debt of many students has been finalized, for some it hasn't, and we recognize that this is something that needs to be urgently concluded. And this slide really, Chairperson, gives you a sense of what we currently know about the debt situation in the universities, and it is based on the 2019 annual reports of institutions where we have been able to do the audited analysis. The 2020 information will be coming to us this year, and it gives you a sense of the fact that the tuition fee, this is just from the year 2017 to 2019, the tuition fee income grows from 25 billion to 30 billion. And the student debt, as you can see, is also growing significantly over that period. In 2017, we're looking at the student debt on the books of the university, and that has grown to nearly 40 billion academic year. If those trends have continued, it's likely that that debt would then grow. And you will also see, that the impairments that universities are having on their books and the net student debt after impairment. The impairment is really high percentage of gross student debt at over 50%, 55.8% in 2019. And the percentage of gross student debt of tuition fees is at 46.1%. So also growing there. So a matter of some serious concern, this is information that is collated from the annual financial statements of the universities. So just to acknowledge the growth, the department is also working on a much more detailed, in-depth analysis of the student debt, looking at information up to the 31st of December 2020. And this will form part of the information that we're using in the review of student financial aid. We looked at four categories of students, so we can try and get a sense of who holds the debt, and we're looking at that at the moment. And initial analysis has been done on that. The department is also working with NSFAS and National Treasury to do the technical work at the moment required for the policy review. Honourable members will know that the department is involved in an urgent short-term process in order to go back to Cabinet and report on the work that needs to be done for the policy review. And we're working quite closely with the universities through USAF and with other key stakeholders, but critically with NSFAS and the National Treasury. And thank you very much, Honourable Members. I think that concludes the presentation from our side. I will hand back to the Deputy Minister in case there are any concluding comments that he would wish to make. And thank you very much for taking the time to listen to our long story.
Thank you, Chair. Maybe before the Deputy Minister comes in, Chair, if you could allow just a minute.
Okay, welcome DG, and switch on your video. You can address.
Yeah, no, I've switched it on. I'm here, sir. I'm not a zombie. Thank you very much.
The video is off, or am I the only one who can see you? Alright.
Oh.
DG?
I know, I'm here, sir. I'm not a zombie. Thank you very much, sir. One important salient feature in the full view of the public, quality assurance bodies play in respect to this current situation, which is confronting the entire system, both universities as well as colleges, as respective sectors in this regard. Having been mindful of the impact that could be in the system as well as the programs that would be delivered and pronounced by institutions at the end, what we did right from the outset, we engaged the quality assurance bodies, both CSE as well as QCTO, so that in respect to program delivery and assessment, they should be working from institutions right from the outset, so that in this changing environment, their expectations in respect to the quality assurance work they do in respect to the program offerings and outcomes thereof is quite compatible with what they would expect in the end, taking into consideration the new change environment which has been imposed by COVID-19 for the entire system of post-school education and training. And indeed, they came to the party, worked with institutions right from the outset in working out how they are going to determine and support institutions so that at the end, the programs that they are offering are of standard which is satisfactory to these quality assurance bodies. Then the second area, which is also important, because the manner in which they monitor the work of institutions and evaluate it thereof, they developed a template that informed plans for monitoring and evaluation at an institutional level for program offerings in the liking and determination of the CHE as well as QCTO, so that there are no comebacks or hiccups at the end, you know, of the academic year when results are being pronounced to students, and then the issues and contestations of quality or lack thereof comes as an after effect. So those practices in the practices and activities as they were adapting to the new environment and changes that are imposed by the situation. And at a high level, there is work which is happening intensely between CHE as well as the Department of Higher Education and Training, University Education Branch in particular, to look at the necessity of reviewing some policies that are in there that would require some changes that would be able to adapt and accommodate the new environment. That work is going on. And the last point I would like to make, taking all this into consideration, there came a need for the reconceptualization of the teaching and learning in its entirety, so that it becomes adaptable and portable in the circumstances in a manner that seeks to reinforce program offerings, research in our institutions as well as in our colleges, so that that what is happening there in terms of quality is not found wanting at the end of the day. And I think that important work, Chair, which the quality councils have played is not always spoken of or out there in the public. But I must say, the work that they have done to enable the situation to be successful as it has been outlined here, it's quite very much huge. And I think at some point the portfolio committee may consider engaging with each of these quality assurance bodies in respect to their role in this changing environment and the kind of support they are actually giving to institutions and the system as a whole. Thank you very much, Chair. I thought I just need to raise that particular issue for the attention of the honorable members. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you very much, DG. I think let's move to Ernest first. And then if the DM wishes to make some concluding remarks, we can do that after the last presentation. I'm going to invite the chairperson, Mr. Ernest Khoza, if he's on the platform, to invite him to make the CEO will come to the platform. Okay, it doesn't look like he's on the platform.
Yes, sir.
Oh, okay. Welcome, Chair of the board of NSFAS. I'm going to invite you to make some remarks and hand over to the CEO. Please fix your video so that we can see you properly. Okay, over to you, Chairperson.
Thank you so much, Chair. And thanks to the chair of the Senate committee as well. Honorable DM, the Director General, our DTGs and honorable members. The DM has already made very profound remarks. I'm not going to make the presentation. We came here, Honorable Chair, with the CEO and members of management who will make the presentations. But just to thank you so much, Honorable Chair, for this opportunity. We have appeared so many times before the Portfolio Committee. We haven't had an opportunity to interact with the Select Committee. Is very grateful for this opportunity. Just by way of remarks, before I hand over to the CEO, the Deputy Minister has already referred to the inherent challenges that we have at NSFAS. I'm aware, Chair, that our presentations will be on specific issues, but I just want to emphasize and to make an effort to bring comfort to both the committees on our appreciation of the inherent challenges that we have in the organization. And the challenges cover a number of areas. Some of them are policy related. Some of them so eloquently elaborated upon by the DDG of higher education, funding problems related to matters of systems. And some of them relate to matters of organizational development. I just want to assure the committees today that we will ultimately resolve these problems. A recognition of problems is the beginning of a resolution of a problem. But it's not going to be overnight. And once again, to borrow the words of the DM, some of these problems are inherent. They've been there for some time, so it will take time to deal with these problems. But as a board, we have got programs to deal this. We're very grateful for the visit that we had last week from the portfolio committee, where we had very helpful engagements on how to deal with some of the problems. I will at this stage, Chair, and to the CEO, who will make a presentation on the areas that we were requested to address the entity. He will also introduce the members of management who are here with us this morning. CEO.
CEO. Chip. Okay, over to you.
To the chair of the committee, portfolio committee, to the chair of the select committee, to the DM, the DGs, and all the honourable members and the colleagues from the department. Chair, mine is going to be quick to introduce the team. The COO will do the presentation for us. With me, I've got all our executives, the COO, as I've mentioned, the governance and risk and executives, the CFO is joining also, and the corporate services executive is joining, and the acting CIO is also joining, Chair. Without wasting much time, Chair, I'll hand over to the COO to do the presentation.
For the TVET, the sector has got controls in place wherein we are not expecting any budgeting shortfall due to the fact that the sector has got the control of money.
Can I interrupt you for a while? Aisha, I think for the benefit of not received it, I think it's better if we're able to follow all of us. So you need us to adjourn a bit so that we can load it in.
Apologies for that, Chair. It's projecting on my side. I think we will have to reload it.
Okay. It's not coming on my screen.
Yeah, also on our screen, Chair. It's not showing.
Yeah. Okay. Maybe we should adjourn for a while, just for body break. We should be back at 10:40, so let's just use the 4 minutes to stretch, and we'll come back at 10:40, so the meeting is adjourned.